This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I have not given up hope that there is still a path towards an end to the violence, but we need to prepare for the very real possibility that Sudan is about to descend into all-out civil war. My concern is that this may quickly become a proxy war.
That's Chris Coons, a member of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, on concerns that the worst may yet to come in Sudan's conflict. Details coming up. Also, Zimbabwe's president vows the next elections will be free and fair. And Forbes Africa announces its famous 30 under 30 list of African innovators. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Fighting raged in the Sudanese capital of Khartoum today after the warring parties locked in a power struggle failed to uphold an overnight ceasefire. Doctors say 5 days of clashes between Sudan's armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces have left nearly 300 people dead and more than 2,000 injured. The Rapid Support Force has announced another 24-hour ceasefire for later today. However, the military has not yet responded. Journalist Michael Atit, reporting for VOA, says that according to Sudan's Ministry of Health Emergency Operations Center, the clashes between the military and Rapid Support Forces so far has left 270 people dead and 2,600 injured across the country. The fighting makes it impossible for VOA to verify casualty figures. Most of the casualties are in Khartoum, where the fighting has stopped essential services like power and water and forced most hospitals to close as thousands of residents flee to the suburbs. Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF, says they again have agreed to a 24-hour ceasefire beginning at 6 p.m. today after 5 days of fighting for control between the RSF and the army. Thomas Okedi is an aid worker with the Norwegian Refugee Council trapped in the town of El Fasher, about 1,290 kilometers north of Khartoum. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that he and his 11 colleagues are sheltering in the same house. They are still hearing gunfire and do not put any faith in another ceasefire announcement.
So since the conflict started on Saturday, it's been extremely tense where I am. Conflict keeps on moving from one neighborhood to another. A lot of artillery and gunfire and displacement of people from one neighborhood to another from within the city. So the situation remains tense. It's now about 5 days since the conflict broke out, and we still don't have any hope of it, going into a lull. So it's extremely worrying.
We just got handed a statement, and I know that this was supposed to happen yesterday at 6 p.m., but now Sudan's RSF forces say they have agreed to a 24-hour ceasefire starting at 6 p.m. this evening, following, you know, all these days of the power struggle between the two generals. Do you believe it's going to happen this evening?
The credibility of any promise depends on whether such a similar promise has been kept in the past. Since the war broke out in Sudan, there have been promises of about two ceasefires or three ceasefires. None of them has been respected. And so I have no faith that even the current one that is being proposed is going to stand. Let's wait and see.
Tell me about your situation with supplies. Do you have how much food, how much water? Do you have what you need to survive for a few more days, or what do you have?
So I'm currently in a house in El Fasher, and I'm living with or hibernating with 11 other colleagues. And before the war broke out, we had stocked a bit of items as part of our emergency preparedness as an organization. However, like any person living in El Fasher, our items are fast running out. We are running out of food. We are running out of water. There is no electricity in the city. Thank God we have solar systems within our house. But how many people within El Fasher city are living in dire conditions? No access to food, no access to water, shelter destroyed. The situation is becoming worrying for the majority of the people, and the healthcare services within the city are becoming extremely stretched, with many people injured and some death reported.
you and your 11 colleagues there, you're staying inside. Does it seem like everybody else around you is doing the same thing?
Most of the people in the city are doing the same thing. There are people who are living in neighborhoods where the conflict is raging, and they have had to endure or risk moving into neighborhoods they considered secure. We have lived in this house for the last 5 days since the conflict broke out, even when there was a lot of gunfire outside and armed people outside our compound, we stayed inside. But conflicts keeps on moving from one neighborhood to another, and some people risk themselves and decide to cross to other neighborhoods where they consider safe. So there's a lot of movement within the city, but under extremely risky conditions.
That's Tobias Okedi, an aid worker with the Norwegian Refugee Council, who has been trapped for 5 days in the town of Al-Fashar. He was speaking today with my colleague Carol Van Dam. Conflict in Sudan's capital has provoked global calls for a ceasefire, but questions remain about how other countries can persuade combatants in Khartoum to lay down their arms. U.S. officials in Congress and the White House say they are using Washington's status and limited leverage to try to make peace. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Fighting has raged in Sudan's capital since Saturday. Two of the nation's power players battle for dominance, with civilians caught in the middle. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he delivered a message to the heads of the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces.
This morning, I made calls to Generals Burhan and Hamedi, urging them to agree to a 24-hour ceasefire, to allow Sudanese to safely reunite with their families, and to obtain desperately needed relief supplies.
General Abdel Fattah Burhan joined forces with General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hamedi, to mount a 2021 coup, but they then turned on each other. And earlier this month, protesters took to Khartoum's streets after talks on a transition to civilian governance stalled. The White House says it is working hard to bring about peace, but declined to say what the consequences would be if the warring parties didn't listen. Karine Jean-Pierre, White House Press Secretary.
We've been very clear about the importance of de-escalating. You've heard Secretary Blinken speak to this. You heard my colleague from NSC speak to this as well. So I'm just not going to go beyond to what they have said.
U.S. lawmakers familiar with the continent say the stakes are high. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware sat down with VOA on Tuesday.
I have not given up hope that there is still a path towards an end to the violence, but we need to prepare for the very real possibility that Sudan is about to descend into all-out civil war. My concern is that this may quickly become a proxy war.
Analysts say the U.S. has little room to maneuver. Washington's ties with Khartoum have long been strained, and the U.S. suspended assistance to Sudan during the 2021 coup. Cameron Hudson, a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, spoke to VOA on Zoom.
Well, I think the challenge here is that the leverage that Washington has left is not leverage that it wants to put on the table, and that's the use of punitive measures. I think for the last 6 months, you've seen Washington, and even since the coup, using an engagement strategy and an incentive strategy to try to bring the generals around to relinquishing power. The problem is that in Sudan's history, these generals don't have a history of responding to incentives, just like they govern the country through fear, intimidation, and their own punitive measures. That's what they respond to themselves.
Kuhn says this needs to be a team effort.
We do have some leverage, but there's other players in the region that also have a lot at stake and some leverage, and we need to work with them in close coordination.
That work has begun, with the Arab League, Egypt, and the United Nations all saying they will work towards peace. But how soon can they put out the flames in Khartoum? Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, who heads the paramilitary rapid support forces, speculated that his rival, Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, had lost control of the military. Asked if his end game was to rule Sudan, Dagalo said he had no such intentions and that there should be a civilian government. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed the validity of his commitment with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
We need to take that sort of statement of support for the democratic civilian government with some skepticism. Both General Hameti and General Burhan have not been very enthusiastic about moving forward with a transition. And moreover, Hameti has long had political ambitions in Sudan. So given their past actions, I think the civilian leaders and general public in Sudan are going to be, you know, taking what Hameti is saying with a large grain of salt. That said, Hameti has done very well financially in recent years by controlling different segments of the economy, including, you know, gold mining operations in the west of the country, which is his base, and with which he has colluded with the Russians and with the Wagner group. So in that way, has grown quite wealthy under the current dispensation. And so I think Hameti may realize he may not need to be president of Sudan so long as he could continue to be a power broker. And if he has that option, continues to be able to wield influence and gain access to resources, he, I think, could be satisfied with that sort of arrangement moving forward.
So what are the ramifications of this fight on Sudan, politically and economically?
We need to keep in mind that Sudan was already reeling from severe economic contractions and instability. Sudan faces over 350% inflation. Its economy has been contracting for at least the past decade under the mismanagement of the military government. It's one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And this, you know, crisis that has erupted into this outright fighting between the factions will only increase Sudan's instability and isolation. And, you know, we should keep in mind that there are other armed groups and there's other fighting happening in Sudan, fighting that bubbled up again after the October 2021 coup led by General Burhan and supported by Hameti. So the longer this fighting goes on, the harder it is going to be to restore order and bring things back to a stable resolution. I think the other takeaway here is that it really underscores that Sudan needs a civilian leadership if it's going to restore stability. The military government has done an abysmal job economically, security, stability, and even now, both of these military actors are pursuing their political interest at the expense of what's good for the country. So I think the takeaway within Sudan and hopefully internationally is going to be that Sudan needs a clean break from the military government of the past. It's going to need legitimate civilian-led government that has popular support to restore credibility domestically, as well as with international actors that will come in only if there's credible technocratic leaders in charge of the government to help rebuild the economy. And, you know, it's that sort of massive investment and support economically from the international actors that's going to be needed to allow Sudan to restabilize.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Migrants in South Africa are celebrating a victory after the Johannesburg High Court declared null and void regulations denying them free health care in government hospitals. Provinces that include Gauteng had enacted regulations that forced pregnant migrants to pay $275 before they could be given any care. The court has now ordered free health care for this group of migrants and their children under the age of six. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In a scathing court judgment, the Johannesburg High Court ordered that the National Department of Health must issue by May 15 a circular to all provincial departments directing them to provide free health care to pregnant migrant women and their children under the age of six. It further ordered all public health facilities to display notices stating that all pregnant and lactating women as well as children below the age of 6 have the right to free care irrespective of their nationality and documentation status. Section 27, a public law interest center, decided to take the Gauteng Department of Health to court. Sasha Stevenson, the head of the health rights program at Section 27, explains why.
Healthcare services during pregnancy are needed to ensure that a woman is safe, that she's able to carry her pregnancy, that her fetus is safe. And indeed, for young children, it's really important that they are able to access the healthcare services that they need.
The ruling has been welcomed by foreign nationals and a number of local South African organizations that supported the court action. Zimbabwean national Mercy Mvundla told VOA that the demand for payment was causing untold suffering to these migrant women, as many of them could not afford services and were being turned away without help.
Quite a relief to us, especially as foreign nationals, mainly to us as women. We are so happy about that. The decision is so good. We thank whoever who helped on doing that, because it was so traumatizing to see another woman giving birth like in the open.
However, not all South Africans are in agreement, including Zweli Ndaba, the chairman of the Sisonke People's Forum.
We are saying enough is enough for illegal people to just do whatever they want to do in this country. That is a disaster itself.
The Gauteng government has not issued a statement yet. However, the court has directed it to come back to the Johannesburg High Court in October and explain how it has implemented the court order. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Tuso Kumalo.
In a speech yesterday marking 43 years of independence from Britain, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa vowed that general elections expected later this year will be free and fair, but issued a warning to rogue civic society organizations. No date has been announced, but the French news agency AFP says the Southern African country is expected to hold presidential and legislative votes in August. The 80-year-old Mnangagwa, who is seeking re-election, urged voters to say no to violence before, during, and after the coming vote. Mnangagwa's ZANU-PF party has been accused in the past of using violence and intimidation to instill fear in opponents during elections, allegations the party has denied. In 2018, he won disputed elections that main rival Nelson Chamisa alleged were rigged. The two will face off for a second time in the vote this year. Mnangagwa replaced strongman ruler Robert Mugabe in 2017 after a military-led coup. He faces widespread discontent as he struggles to ease entrenched poverty and end chronic power cuts and crippling unemployment. Forbes Africa Business Magazine recently announced its famous 30 Under 30 list of African innovators. Called Tomorrow's Titans, it's filled with 20-something-year-olds who Forbes says are doing amazing work in a variety of fields, from health to technology to fashion. The magazine says this year's crop of excellence includes young achievers who built solutions-oriented businesses from scratch. Darren Taylor reports.
When Dr. Werdu Somelekai announced she was opening Botswana's first medical aesthetics practice in Gaborone a few years ago, few in the Southern African nation knew what she was speaking about. Medical aesthetics is a field in modern medicine aimed at altering patients' cosmetic appearance. Procedures that Somelekai and her team at MediGlow Aesthetics do include removing scars, wrinkles, moles, excess fat, and unwanted hair.
Aesthetic medicine is a relatively new industry in Botswana especially, but even on the continent. And so getting the recognition will spark a lot of curiosity in people and hopefully get them interested in the kind of services that we offer, and hopefully bring in more clients for the clinic.
Africans who want cosmetic surgery usually have to travel to developed countries to get it, but Somalekai's service now means they are able to receive it at home. In Nigeria, Blessing Abeng's company, Ingressive for Good, is equipping West African youth with the tech skills they need to build their own businesses and to get jobs.
So far, we've trained about 132,000 people, training them in tech skills and placed thousands in jobs. So getting this recognition has been really inspiring, but even more for people in my industry and people in tech. Most of the people who were responding and saying congratulations also sort of felt like the life that they want is possible and has inspired them to come take courses. We currently have a scholarship, a cybersecurity scholarship in partnership with Cisco, and the application for that has really, really soared.
Lesotho's Kwale Manoheng is director of Kansa Energy.
We have been the ones we've been waiting for years now, and this recognition really allows us to take charge.
His company provides solar power to rural communities throughout the tiny mountain kingdom, giving them electricity which they otherwise wouldn't have. Manoheng says the Forbes award is unexpected, but very welcome.
One thing for me that's really important is going back home. And this really gives us an opportunity to spotlight, you know, the plight of energy poverty in Lesotho and energy access, work that we've actually been doing. When it comes to other focus areas such as climate change awareness, you know, really bringing it into the social dialogue, bringing it closer to people who necessarily don't understand what we're dealing with here. For me, coming from a least developed country like Lesotho and being the first under 30 from Lesotho, it's actually very affirming, but it also opens up doors for others. You know, I don't walk this path by myself.
Abeng's advice to young African innovators is to start businesses slowly and with humility.
Most times we overestimate what we can do in a day and underestimate what we can do in a year. It's not enough to show the work. You have to do both. You have to do the work and show the work. You have to show the results. But most importantly, do one thing every day to be better and bring you closer to your goals. The results will always speak for you. Ask for help when you need it. When you find a problem that is worth solving, go right ahead and solve it. The only way that you learn is by experimenting.
All three entrepreneurs say they had to make many mistakes before they found a recipe for success. As Manoheng puts it, it takes bravery to bounce back from failure. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1. Then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.